from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Charles Schwab is best known as a financier and investment whiz. Having built a company with millions of clients and trillions in assets, few would say he's lazy or dumb. But that's exactly how he felt growing up unable to read, as he told interviewer Charlie Rose in 2002.
I flunked English A two times in college. I couldn't write a composition. I couldn't finish a book.
Schwab has dyslexia, an oft misunderstood brain disorder which makes reading slow and painful. But new research is revealing the root causes of dyslexia and new strategies for dealing with it. Today on the program, we're talking about changes in the way we view and treat dyslexia. That's coming up after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. We don't know precisely how many people have dyslexia, but we do know that it's a lot. About one in five children in America, that's 20%, have some kind of reading disability. And that's really what dyslexia is. As the National Institute of Health puts it, dyslexia is an inability to process graphic symbols. It's not about comprehension or intelligence, but rather wiring in the brain. Today on the program, what dyslexia is and new ways to help dyslexic kids and adults read. Joining us this hour, Dr. Sally Shaywitz. She's the Audrey G. Ratner Professor in Learning Development at the Yale University School of Medicine and co-director of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. She's the author of over 250 scientific articles, chapters, and books, including Overcoming Dyslexia. And Dr. Sally Shaywitz joins us from Audiolutions in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Dr. Shaywitz, thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here with you.
And we invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments about dyslexia. 801-585-WEST is our number, 801-585-9378, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Shaywitz, I want to start with the beginning of your research. You started looking at dyslexia in 1987, what you call a watershed year for research into reading disabilities. How much did you know about dyslexia when you started down this path?
Not very much. I always thought it was some arcane entity that was only known to the British and other sophisticated people.
So why did you hop on this bandwagon? What got you most interested?
Yeah, well, I am a pediatrician by training, and I began to see a behavioral pediatrician, many, many children whose prime complaint was school difficulties. And when you looked at it further, it was a reading problem. And I was struck by several things. One was how this impacted not only the child, but his or her entire family. How many tears I saw and how much distress. And I was also impressed by how little we knew and by how so many studies had focused on children who had been identified by a school or clinic, but we didn't know much about children who might be sitting quietly, not bothering anybody, but also not learning to read.
Mm. You write that reading is an extraordinary ability, peculiarly human and yet distinctly unnatural. I'm curious what you mean by that, distinctly unnatural.
Well, when you think about it, how do we, when we look at a letter, why don't we just see that this is abstract circles and lines? So how do we know that they form letters and the letters form words and the words have meaning? So if we compare what we know about spoken language to written language, it begins to make a little more sense. So, for example, spoken language has been around hundreds of thousands of years, and virtually every society has a spoken language. And as human beings, we're naturally wired for spoken language. So if a newborn baby comes into the world, we don't run out and buy the spoken language curricula to teach that baby how to speak, because over time that baby will babble and then say single words and phrases and so forth, because speaking is natural. It's instinctive. So if we compare that to reading, Well, reading's been around, not hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, maybe 5 or 6,000 years. Many societies on Earth still don't have a written language. And as human beings, we're not naturally hardwired for print. So as opposed to spoken language, which is natural and doesn't have to be taught, written language, print, is artificial, and it has to be taught.
If you ask the average person on the street, I bet, you know, what a dyslexic is, what dyslexia is, I bet you'd get an answer something like this. It's a person who sees letters backwards, and so that inhibits their reading ability. You say this is a myth.
Yeah, you're so right. No matter whom you speak with, they could be a professor at a major university or the man on the street. That's exactly what they'll say. And that myth has persisted. But what's really exciting now is that we've gone from an age of myths and anecdotes to hard science. And we know that the major difficulty in reading is getting to the specific individual sounds of spoken language. I'll repeat that. It's getting to the sounds of spoken language.
So that's what dyslexia is. It's about sound?
Yes, it's getting to the sounds of spoken language. People who are dyslexic have great difficulty appreciating the individual sounds of spoken words and don't have a good ability to pull spoken word apart into its individual sounds. And let me tell you why that's important. Because if you look at a printed word, how do you know what it means? How can you read it? If you think back to your child's or your own childhood, teachers would say, sound it out. So in order to read, a person has to be able to pull apart the spoken word into its individual sounds. And then that child and then the adult can link each letter to the sound it represents and sound it out. And I'll go one step further. Because the basic difficulty is getting to the sounds of spoken language, dyslexia affects spoken language. Because they're called phonemes, these individual, very small units of sound, are not as crisp and as clear as they are for other people. People who are dyslexic, who want to say something, they may know the meaning of what they want to say, the idea. For example, if they want to say the word bat, they'll have that concept, and they'll be able to, the jargon is activate the semantic representations. They'll be able to, in their mind, have the word. But the next step, after knowing the meaning, is to have to transform that word into the individual sounds that represent the word. They have to access and retrieve these individual sounds in order to utter the spoken word, because the sounds are what program your lips and tongue and mouth to say the word. So people who are dyslexic often have trouble. It's called word retrieval. They know what they want to say, but they can't retrieve it. So they may retrieve a word that sounds similar. If they want to say tornado, they might say volcano. Or as a colleague told me, her little dyslexic son, whenever in New York City they would pass the cloisters, would say, oh, I really like the oysters. So he knew what he wanted to say, but the words would come out. And also what happens, you often get a lot of ums. And so the person knows what he wants to say, but he doesn't sound glib, and that might make them even more anxious, and so it gets even more difficult. The problem is, we as a society often judge a person on how glib they are. So a person who's dyslexic can be incredibly smart, know what they want to say, but it won't come out exactly right.
This current understanding of dyslexia is quite different from historically what doctors were thinking was causing this. And you write in your book that the early days of the disorder, this condition was called word blindness, that it was somehow linked visually, like a visual issue.
Exactly. You've done your reading well. what happened is initially in 1896, a British physician in the British Medical Journal described a young man, 14, Percy, who was bright in every other way, But he couldn't read. In fact, he said he would be the brightest in the class if it wasn't for that he had to read. And then Percy was taken to see an ophthalmologist, because you read with your eyes, and thought, well, the problem must be in your eyes. And all of us can picture when we go to have our eyes examined, we see the eye chart, the Jager print. So these children were given charts to read, and people thought, well, I'll make the letters bigger and bigger and bigger, and they'll be able to read. But, of course, they couldn't. And one very prescient ophthalmologist at the time, a Dr. Hinchelwood, said, I don't know what the problem is, but I know it's not the eyes.
Maybe fast forward to where we are today and just give us a primer on Neuroscience 101. What do we know about how the brain processes language, and how is that different from the way the brain processes numbers?
Okay. Well, we're still learning a lot about how the brain processes numbers, but we know a great deal about how the brain processes language and print. About 20 years ago, my colleague and husband, Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, who's actually the Charles Schwab Professor of Dyslexia and Learning Development at Yale, came to me and said, you know, I know what we're going to do. And I said, what's that? And he said, we're going to image reading. I said, how would we do that? Well, he understood, and the rest, as they say, is history. What is now possible, for instance, is to do something called functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI. For all your listeners who have ever had an MRI for a torn tendon or headaches, it's basically the same apparatus, but at a higher level. So what you can do is you can have someone lie down in a scanner, look through what's like a periscope, and you can show them different words and ask them questions about those words that will reveal their ability to read them or not. And we, as many others worldwide, have carried out these investigations. So the very first thing that was so interesting is that the areas of the brain that are responsible for being able to read are on the same side of the brain, the left side, the left hemisphere, and in many ways overlap the areas for spoken language. An area in the front of the brain called the inferior frontal gyrus, in the middle of the brain called the parietal temporal region, and in the back of the brain at the occipitotemporal region, all on the left side. And remember what I said earlier, that in order to read, you have to pull apart the sounds to spoken language and attach each letter to the sound. So it's not surprising that the systems for reading are very similar and in some cases overlap the systems for speaking. And what's been so exciting is that these findings, and I'll tell you what they are in dyslexia, have been found in virtually every language, not only English, Italian, German, French, a fairly similar findings also in logographic languages like Chinese. Not exactly the same, but quite similar. So what you find is that in people who are dyslexic, in particular, an area in the back of the brain, sort of, you know, when a child gets swollen glands behind the ear, it would be that area underneath the skull and the brain called the occipitotemporal region for those lobes that are where it is, and or the word form area, it's easier. And that area is really important, because that area doesn't function efficiently in people who are dyslexic. So as a result, people who are dyslexic can't read very quickly. Let me just backtrack a little bit. In order to learn to read, a person first has to be able to pull apart and notice the sounds of spoken language. Then they have to learn the letters and connect the letters to the sounds and sound out the word. That's a very effortful procedure. And after doing it again and again, children learn how to read accurately, but they're still having to use a lot of energy and a lot of effort to do it. After a while, and very early on, beginning of elementary school, maybe at the end of first grade, beginning of second grade, children learn to read more and more words automatically. So it's no longer manual, it's automatic. They don't have to laboriously read the word. They see it and they know it. So reading becomes quick, accurate, and a pleasure. that process of being able to read words automatically takes place in this word form area of the brain. And this area is not working efficiently in people who are dyslexic. Mm. So if you're dyslexic, no matter how smart you are, no matter how hard you work, and what instruction you've had, chances are overwhelmingly that you reading for you will be effortful and you'll read slowly. And similarly, that if you have to retrieve words in spoken language, that will be problematic and you won't be glib.
Is the disorder more prevalent in boys or in girls, or is it equal opportunity there?
That's a great question. It used to be thought it was more prevalent in boys, and that had a lot of consequences. If you think a problem only occurs in one group, for example, in school, it might be those are the ones you look at to identify, and it's also the ones who are studied in terms of research. Then in the early 1990s, we carried out a study. I direct a study called the Connecticut Longitudinal Study, which is a random sample of Connecticut school children, not selected because they had reading problems or any problems, just a random sample. And what we found is that there were a few more boys, but fairly equal, boys and girls. But then when we asked, and this was based on our individual assessment of each child, but when we asked schools for the same children who they identified, we found schools were identifying maybe three times as many boys. And then when we looked further, it won't surprise you to hear this, who were they identifying? They were identifying the children who were problematic in the class, you know, the little boy throwing the airplane across the room or pulling the girl's hair who sat in front of him. It was a biased selection because the children weren't picked because they were struggling readers necessarily. They may have been, but they were primarily behavior problems in the classroom. Mm. So the bottom line is there are relatively similar numbers of boys and girls, maybe a few more boys, but not significantly so. But boys will often tend to get identified for evaluation because they're troublesome, whereas little girls who may be sitting quietly in their class and reading may be overlooked.
You're talking about the Connecticut study and
yes,
studying school children. Does that indicate that this problem, that dyslexia, goes away over time, that you somehow grow out of it?
You're asking such good questions. What has been so interesting, and we have now followed this population from kindergarten into their third decade, it doesn't go away. The problem persists. It's a lifelong issue. But as I'm speaking, I would be really remiss if I didn't share with you the conceptual model for dyslexia, because I don't want to only talk about weaknesses. Dyslexia is basically an encapsulated or circumscribed weakness in getting to the sounds of spoken words affecting both spoken language and written language. But at the same time, it's surrounded by a sea of strength in higher level thinking, reasoning, for example, such areas as concept formation, comprehension, problem solving, critical thinking are all very well developed in dyslexics. That's why incredibly brilliant people who have really changed the way our society thinks have been dyslexic. You mentioned Charles Schwab. He's a wonderful human being, and he has said, "I when I'm thinking about something, I can see the end zone before others who are stuck thinking sequentially." And I think that's his dyslexia. Probably the most brilliant and compassionate attorney in the country, David Boies, who took on the single-sex marriage, I think it was Proposition 8 in California, and represented Department of Justice versus Microsoft, and also represented Vice President Gore versus Bush in Florida. David Boies is very dyslexic and very public about it, and he always says that people should realize it's not about how fast you read. Life's not a race. It's about how well you think. And David Boies thinks better than anyone I know. And as I said, he's dyslexic. Mm. John Irving, the writer, You would think, well, how could you be a writer and be dyslexic? He is very dyslexic. And in my book, the last chapter, as you may have seen, is called The Epilogue, A Person Like That, where I wanted to write about people who have accomplished things that you wouldn't imagine a dyslexic can. And so the first person I wrote about was John Irving. And when I interviewed him, he was gracious enough to allow me to publish his comments. And he said, I read slowly. And when I'm tired, it's even worse, because when you're dyslexic, you're not reading automatically. You have to put a lot of effort and attention into your reading, and it gets very tiring. Mm. Oh, I should add, too, Carol Greider, who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2009, is very dyslexic. She had trouble with word retrieval as well as with reading quickly and didn't do well on her GREs. And so she was rejected from 8 out of 10 graduate programs. The irony is, two schools, and she went to, I believe, UC Berkeley, who were smart enough to accept her. That's when she did her Nobel Prize winning work. And here, also, I should mention Philip Schultz, who won a Pulitzer Prize for poetry, is also very dyslexic and has written a very moving memoir called My Dyslexia.
We're talking about dyslexia, the dyslexic brain, and reading disabilities generally. We invite you to join us. Joining us is Dr. Sally Shaywitz, co-director of the Center for Dyslexia and Creativity at Yale and author of Overcoming Dyslexia. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is our number, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and today on the program, we're demystifying dyslexia. Dr. Sally Shaywitz is with us. She's the head of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity, author of the book Overcoming Dyslexia. And if you've got questions or comments, give us a call, 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. This email from Keith in Ogden, he writes, as a person with mild dyslexia, I did not come into my own until graduate school. When I would do class-assigned readings that were very complex and highly technical, I would be able to match my peers' rate of production, not because I could read them faster, but because I could, looks like he's missing a word there, understand the complex literature at the same rate as the normal students. Frequently, I could read with better comprehension because I made efforts to learn more vocabulary to cover for intermittent anomia. I'm not sure what that word is.
Anomia is really sort of what we're talking about with word retrieval.
Okay.
And getting to come up with.
So Keith's experience of discovering dyslexia in early adulthood, even late adulthood, how common is that?
Extremely common. In fact, Charles Schwab will say that he only discovered his dyslexia, even though he'd had very classic dyslexia experiences growing up, he discovered his own when his son was diagnosed. Very often going through school, particularly very bright individuals self-accommodate. They work harder and they're very bright. They can develop really good vocabularies and learn little different ways to self-accommodate. And very often too, teachers who see the hard work and the intelligence will say, well, you know, Johnny, I know you know this, but I notice you're not finishing your test. So why don't you stay a little later, stay through lunchtime and finish this? Or some other teachers will help by giving the students breaks between parts of the exam. Or, for example, not counting spelling errors. There have been many very wonderful teachers I've heard about who have been such support to students. And so the students haven't been officially diagnosed or identified, but the difficulties have been there. But when you get to college or professional schools and graduate schools, then, you know, the work really increases so much and the reading increases so much. What's really very important for your listeners to know, many may be aware there's an Americans with Disabilities Act, but in 2008, an Americans with Disabilities Amendment Act was passed. And that was to make sure it covered a great many disabilities, but I'm going to just focus on the dyslexia. It named dyslexia specifically and wanted to make sure that people who were self-accommodated and did well weren't going to be penalized when they requested accommodations. Accommodations are critical. Basically, dyslexia robs a person of time because of the inefficient functioning of the word form area. Accommodations return it. I've heard from so many individuals how having that extra time made such a difference and allowed them to have the examination reflect their ability rather than their disability. And the other area to mention is people who are dyslexic and are put on the spot because they have the word retrieval. If this is an oral exam and of high importance, that individual disability will be reflected. It will not be an accurate indicator of what they know and their fund of knowledge. So it's very important to appreciate this because we as a society have determined that people who have disabilities like dyslexia, they have a right to have their abilities and not their disabilities reflected, particularly in high-stakes examinations.
Sure. Keith, thanks for the email. 801-585-WEST is our number, and let's go to the phones. Iva Lou is joining us from Bountiful, Utah. Iva Lou, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I'm calling because I have a six-year-old who will be starting first grade, and my husband has dyslexia. However, he does enjoy reading, but he had a lot of trouble, I think, in grade school as a result of it. Are there signs that I can be watching for with my daughter? She has a great vocabulary, but I noticed in kindergarten she didn't love to read too much.
Dr. Shaywitz.
Yeah, I think knowing that dyslexia emanates from a difficulty getting to the sounds of spoken words, you can look for signs. And in fact, I have my book in front of me, so I'm cheating a little bit here. On page 122, there were clues to dyslexia in early childhood. My point is, because it basically involves the sound, the spoken language system, you can look for signs before a child's expected to read. Sometimes it'll be slightly delayed speaking. And children and adults who are dyslexic have trouble noticing the individual parts of words. So one of the first things children have to notice is, for example, to appreciate rhymes, you have to notice that mat, cat, sat, nat all end in at. So children who are dyslexic often don't appreciate rhymes. Or if you ask them to tell you words that rhyme, they may not be able to. They may mispronounce a lot of words. They may have trouble learning their letters and to associating the sounds with letters. And their mispronunciations are not baby talk, but they're true mispronunciations. So I think if you see some of these signs and you are concerned, I would discuss it with your child's teacher and perhaps the principal, or if they have a reading teacher in school. But at this early stage, it's sometimes the people who can do the very best job are our speech and language pathologists, because there are now, certainly for a six-year-old, available tests of spoken language. That test, they're called phonologic, P-H-O-N-O, like phonograph. They're able to test a child's ability to get to the sounds of words, to pull spoken words apart, and do all the things you need to do in order to learn to read. So those are the kinds of people maybe 4 to 6 year olds are often best served by in having them evaluated.
Iva Lou, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST is our number. And we'll go to Jennifer in Roy, Utah. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
You know, I'm loving listening to this program because it's mentioning a lot of things that my family's known for quite some time. My uncle Billy is dyslexic. They noticed that in the early 60s when he was in grade school. And the minute they found it out, it made a lot of things make sense for him. And every day my grandmother would sit down and they'd work with him, and he worked very hard. And now in his 40s, he's almost 50 now, he's retired and he's a millionaire. You know, he's actually going after his executive master's now to do other things in his life. He's made it so that this doesn't stop him. He's worked very, very hard to make the disability not disable him.
Jennifer, thanks for sharing that
story. That's very nicely put.
And Dr. Shaywitz, throughout your book, you write about kind of this resilience that dyslexia brings out in people, you know, that this disorder is not going to limit people from their ambitions.
Well, it's really interesting how many of our most accomplished people, as I mentioned, physicians, particularly often people like psychiatrists who have not only a lot of knowledge, but a lot of empathy, of which our physicians certainly can use more of very often, attorneys like David Boies, entrepreneurs, scientists, have dyslexia. I want to share with you, because I mentioned before the what we call the sea of strengths model of an encapsulated weakness and getting to spoken words surrounded by a sea of strengths. We've developed what I'm going to tell you. So how can a person tell if they may be dyslexic? And what I've tried to do here is not only note the weakness, but also the strengths. And this may help many of your listeners to understand and maybe know if they or someone they care about is dyslexic. So you may be dyslexic if you read slowly and with much effort, but are often to solve the problem. You may be dyslexic if you can't spell, have messy handwriting, but your writing shows terrific imagination, for example, John Irving. You may be dyslexic if you have trouble remembering dates and names, but think out of the box and grasp the big picture. Probably our finest living cardiac surgeon, Dr. Delos Cosgrove, who's now CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, talks about how he reads slowly, but he thinks differently, and I think he has about 30 patents, and his inventions have made cardiac surgery infinitely more safe and brought joy to many people.
Well,
and
so
finally, one more. You may be dyslexic if you have difficulty retrieving and pronouncing spoken words, which is so common, but have an excellent, at the same time, have an excellent vocabulary and ideas.
Well, I mean, clearly, exceptional people, this disorder is not placing limitations on what they want to accomplish. And yet, in your book, you write that dyslexia does inflict pain. There are social stigmas that continue to proliferate around this disorder.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up. Because dyslexia is what's called a hidden disability, people look bright in every other way. People accuse the person who's dyslexic of not trying hard enough. And in fact, in my book, I quote John Irving, who said the thing that bothered him the most when people said that he wasn't motivated or trying hard enough. And people can't understand, well, for example, speaking and reading come so easily to most of us. How could, you know, how quite you couldn't get the word out? Or how, you know, why can't you read quicker? It's a no-brainer for me. It's so easy. So there's so much misunderstanding. And also, because being able to read is often equated with being smart. If you're very smart, you must be a good reader. And if you're a good reader, you must be very smart. So there's a real stigma and a real prejudice associated with being dyslexic. And many people who are dyslexic will tell about childhoods where when they had to read aloud in class, they were made fun of, they were bullied, they were called retarded. And so people have a lot of shame. And because there's nothing to show visually for it, they often are very hesitant to talk about it. So I think that one of the difficulties is the stigma and the shame. But very interestingly, in a year ago, we published a paper in the journal Psychologic Science with our good friend and colleague Emilio Farrar, And what we did is we wanted to look at what happens to intelligence and reading over time, and we could use our longitudinal study population to do that. And when we looked at that, you know what we found? We found that reading and intelligence were kissing cousins. They went together over time and affected one each other. So this was in typical readers. But then we were very clever. We had a very large group of dyslexic readers who we, too, had followed over time. And when we looked at the relationship between reading and intelligence, we found they weren't kissing cousins. They weren't even talking to each other. And it showed that you can have a very high level of intelligence but a low level of reading, because the sine qua non of a diagnosis of dyslexia is unexpected. And here, visually, in the figures that went along with the scientific article, you could see intelligence could be at a very high level, but yet reading or retrieving words at a much lower level. So dyslexia is a paradox. It doesn't go along with what people expect or think. And our job as physician scientist is to do translational medicine, is to translate what we've learned scientifically about dyslexia to help ensure that it actually improves the health and lives of people who are dyslexic.
This hour, we're talking about dyslexia and reading disabilities. If you'd like to join us, 801-585-WEST is our number, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. In this hour, Understanding and Conquering Dyslexia. Dr. Sally Shaywitz is with us. She's the head of the Center for Dyslexia and Creativity at Yale and author of the book Overcoming Dyslexia. Has dyslexia touched your life? Join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is our number. 801-585-9378. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. And we'll go back to the phones. Fred is with us from Salt Lake City. Fred, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate your letting me talk to you today. Although, even though this is an anonymous call, it's very difficult because you talk about the shame that's associated with it, and I still have a very difficult time, even late in life, to admit that I have difficulty reading. And I learned to read prior to going to elementary school, but I learned that, for me, each word was a picture or a glyph or a hieroglyph almost that had meaning in and of itself, but I was clear into graduate school before I found out that that was not how other people read, that other people were taught in a different way and that they learned in a different way. And, of course, during reading classes and things like that, I was totally befuddled and had no idea what was going on because my system had no relationship to what that teacher was doing and consequently was seen as a total failure in reading.
Fred, thank you so much for sharing your story. Dr. Shaywitz?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that very often, or perhaps not very often, but at times, people who are dyslexic can learn to read early because they memorize the words, and often just how I think was Fred was describing, sort of trying to associate an image or a picture with it. But as children go on, after third grade or fourth grade, there are just too many words and they're too long and too complicated, and many of them look so similar that if you haven't learned how to pull apart a word and sound it out, you run into great difficulties. And it may be of interest for your listeners to know that dyslexia also occurs in Japanese and in Chinese, where there are logographs.
Fred, thanks so much for the call. 801-585-WEST is our number. We'll go to Jeannie in Sandy, Utah. Jeannie, hi.
Hi. I first of all wanted to say thanks for putting a spotlight on this subject. It's so important to me. And also, my daughter is 16 years old. She's dyslexic. She has two male cousins that were diagnosed dyslexic, and I'm pretty sure my father was also dyslexic. She's really done well. She's learned so many ways to compensate. She reads really well now, but it's a funky style. One thing in our family is my husband is from Germany. We both speak German quite often at home, and she's heard both languages her whole life. And I was just kind of wondering, because she had extra sounds, language sounds in her life since she was small, if that could have been what helped her boost her ability to read.
Hmm. Interesting question, Jeannie. Thanks so much. Dr. Shaywitz?
I think that's an interesting observation. And on one hand, it could make sense, but I'm not aware of any scientific evidence that would either support or refute this very interesting observation. But I will say that because people who are dyslexic have trouble getting to the basic sounds and sound system of their primary language, very often what is extremely difficult for people who are dyslexic is learning a foreign or a second language. And actually recognizing that difficulty, we at Yale for the last, maybe 15 or 20 years, have a policy in place that if a person is dyslexic and they can request a partial waiver of the foreign language requirement. So they're not excused from it, but they take, for example, a course in the culture of that country, because we know originally I presented this idea to our foreign language department, and I must say they were somewhat skeptical, but agreeable. And now 15, 20 years later, they will call me and say, Dr. Shaywitz, I have this wonderful young man. He's tried so hard. I've met with him after class. He's had a tutor, but he will not be able to master the language at the level expected at Yale, and it's siphoning off all his time and energy from other courses in which he can be successful in. And now I can tell you the story of a really lovely young lady who's a student at Yale and who is dyslexic, and she received a partial waiver of her foreign language requirement and got so interested in the culture of different countries that she studied that she is now majoring in history. So it's so I think smart, because here she's been able to benefit. And why do you want to speak a foreign language? One of the reasons is to become familiar with a country that speaks a different language, and she's been able to do that, although she could never master that language itself.
This email sort of dovetails in the response from education. This is from Shadia in Salt Lake City, who writes, what do you recommend that one does when your school and district seem to approach helping dyslexic students in a one-shoe-fits-all fashion? How does one help educators and administrators catch the vision in this day of education being driven by testing? So the multiple choice test, I imagine, is quite a hurdle for someone with dyslexia.
It's an incredible hurdle, because in order to do well on a multiple choice test, we're not even gonna, you have to read what's called the stem of the question, and you have to remember what that stem is, and then you have to read all the choices, which all may be similarly worded, and so you have to read and reread, and it is a real it really calls upon all the areas that people who are dyslexic have difficulties with. What we and others are attempting to do now is to educate the general public and educators. Educators want to do the right thing, but what we've surprisingly found is that while many educators are knowledgeable and supportive, there are many others who are not knowledgeable. I would also recommend that you might find some very helpful advice. Dr. Bennett Shaywitz and I founded the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity to try to offer help to people like yourself, trustworthy and authoritative help. So the website is www.dyslexia.yale.edu.
We're speaking with Dr. Sally Shaywitz, co-director of the Center for Dyslexia and Creativity at Yale, author of the book Overcoming Dyslexia. I want to read this email from Laura, who writes, "Is dyslexia often wrapped up with other disorders? My little 9-year-old had a difficult time learning to read and shows signs of autism as well, but when tested, did not really fit the criteria. He now reads well and has a truly amazing mind." And I want to go to this phone call from Michelle in Salt Lake City, who has a question on a similar vein. Michelle, go right ahead.
Yes, I wondered if children who suffer from dyslexia are often prematurely diagnosed with ADD or other behavior disorders, which kind of result from their struggles and their inability to fit in.
That those are two very great questions. One is, I'm not aware of an association between dyslexia and autism. Often, just as your listener described, it's often sometimes very different. But combination of dyslexia and attentional difficulties is, in fact, very common. In medicine, we refer to when a person has two problems at the same time, a comorbidity. The co-occurrence of dyslexia and attentional difficulties varies among studies, but it's sometimes between 40% and 50% if a child or an adult has one, they'll have another. And so that's a very, very high co-occurrence. And it's also important because when most children, as I mentioned a little earlier, learn to read, the initial process is manual. You have to work hard. And you have to pay attention because it's a manual process. And we, as humans, only have like a bucket of attention. So if you're still not an automatic reader, it's called fluency. If you're not a fluent reader, which dyslexics are not, you're using up all of that attention to try to figure out the word in front of you or to say the word you want to say. So people who are dyslexic often use up all their attention. So whether somebody has what's diagnosed as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or is a dyslexic struggling to read or to speak, to retrieve words, that person will use up all their attention. And so there is a very, very common co-occurrence. And in fact, many people believe that if someone is diagnosed with one, they should be evaluated for the other. And the other co-occurrence, which is very, very striking, is dyslexia and anxiety. So many people, and I have seen now thousands of individuals who are dyslexic, and others report in the scientific literature a very big overlap, comorbidity between dyslexia and anxiety. And that gets worse often over time because you can imagine a person who knows their work, who has studied hard, and then they go in to take what's either a time test and they can't help but read slowly or an oral exam and they know the material, but they can't retrieve the word. Mm-hmm. So that anxiety grows. So both attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and anxiety disorder have a very high co-occurrence with dyslexia.
Speaking of anxiety, this email from Twinkle speaks to that issue. I have dyslexia to this day. I'm a very slow reader. I was a TV reporter for years and always hated having to be live on the set and to read the teleprompter. 801-585-WEST is our number. We'll take another call from Sandy in Fillmore, Utah. Sandy, hi. Sandy, are you there?
I'm here.
Go right ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing for dyslexia awareness. My husband is dyslexic, and at least 3 out of our 7 children are dyslexic so far. And, you know, if there's been a person who has the T-shirt, it's our family. Mm-hmm. We've gone through everything that you've discussed on the program, and I appreciate those that are out there trying to help these children. What I have to offer, I guess, is a note for parents that please don't treat your child like this is a disability. Treat it like a gift, like it is a talent, an immense talent, and do everything for them to help them develop their talent. their gifts for inventions, their gifts for creativity. You know, I've had teachers tell me that my children will never go to college. They'll never be smart enough. School is not for them. Hmm. I've heard every kind of thing. I've had my children accused of cheating, everything you can think of. But be their advocate. Be the one who says, I think you have a gift. Please, you know, be what you can be and don't worry about being what they want you to be.
Sandy, thanks so much. You've brought up such an important issue, the misunderstanding of dyslexia, what dyslexia individuals have to go through, and also the limit that's put on the great potential of people who are dyslexic. There have been so many people who are dyslexic that have won Nobel Prizes, Pulitzer Prizes, the Pritzker Prize in architecture. But one of the major things that are standing in the way is the misunderstanding and misuse of denying people who have a significant difficulty in getting to the sounds of words and who aren't glib and can't retrieve words and can't read quickly accommodations on high-stakes tests. High-stakes tests are now the gatekeeper in our country, and decisions are made often denying very hardworking, very capable, very dyslexic individuals the accommodation that will allow them to show their strengths. Everybody should become familiar with the Americans with Disabilities Amendment Act of 2008, because that tells you very explicitly, the wonderful Congressman George Miller, Joe Courtney, Pete Stark, and others spoke about dyslexia and how this relatively new law protects individuals who are dyslexic so they can go on and use their potential and contribute to society.
Dr. Sally Shaywitz, co-director of the Center for Dyslexia and Creativity at Yale University and author of the book Overcoming Dyslexia, joined us from Martha's Vineyard. Thanks so much, Dr. Shaywitz, for your time today.
You're very welcome.
And thanks to everyone for their calls and emails. You can continue the discussion online at KUER.org/Radio West. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Thanks to Tim Slover today. The show is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. The executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. And I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.